Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Today, I'm happy to have as my guest Scott McClanahan. He's a young author, but he's written quite a few books already. The most recent is the Sarah book. It's published by one of the best of the small independent presses. That's Tyrant Press. He's the author as well of Crapalacha. I think that was published by another favorite small press, $2 Radio. The Sarah book is a book about the end of a marriage, the excitement of a marriage, the terror of a marriage, and the bonded condition. And Crapalacha is a book that is attempting to define the place where this author, Scott McClanahan, is from. He's from West Virginia. He scolds other writers for writing an Appalachian minstrel show.
I put that at the end of Crapalacha, in some ways not realizing how insulting it would seem to the people that I mentioned there. It was more out of, I guess, frustration, just with the type of writing that comes from the region, the types of books that are published from the region, historical fiction, sort of kind of quasi-social realism. So I put that there more as just like a little joke that I thought was kind of silly. But yeah, I believe that there's probably some honesty there in the way that the region has been stereotyped and, you know, continues to be stereotyped. The Appalachian stereotype, at least as I understand it, is typically, you know, we have the old concept of the mountaineer, right, or Daniel Boone, which is this kind of frontier myth of strength and this solitary individual. That image changed, though, once, like, mineral rights became an issue, and I think you can tie this to kind of the industrialization of just the region of the coal mining industry. And there you see early part of the 20th century, that image changed into something very, very different, right? Which is, you know, backwards and inbred and subhuman in many ways.
Well, my impression is, you know, and it's just mine, is that Scott McClanahan, my guess, is a real writer. These books are run on a kind of prose energy. They are often ferocious and ferociously funny. And they have a, they're not God's Little Acre.
Yeah.
And they're not books of predictable moonshine lullaby. Nor is the Sarah book, the book about marriage, your typical marriage. The narrator warns us from the very first page. It's astounding. Parts of this book are plagiarized.
Yes.
Now, I think that as a writer, you depend upon administering minute and sometimes not so minute shocks to the reader. And I wondered what it means parts of this book are plagiarized.
I thought it was funny to tell the reader that part of the book that they are reading is plagiarized and stolen, because I believe that's sort of the history of writing in some ways. Beyond the lines that I've taken from other works and incorporated into the book itself, I was also thinking on a larger level of the way in which, you know, we create ourselves, and our personalities are stolen in some ways from others, whether it's our genetic makeup of our parents, or I can remember I have this friend Tim, and we're still friends, but early in the friendship, I just thought, he walks so cool, right? I want to walk like that. And you can almost feel yourself taking on aspects of other people who you're close with.
Parts of this book are plagiarized from life.
Yeah.
This is a life book about a marriage to Sarah, but it's transforming that marriage into the Sarah book. And in the Sarah book, there are sections that are plagiarized from life.
Yes, exactly.
This book is full of feeling, embittered feeling, feelings of love, strong, crazy feelings of yearning and loss. We're going to hear the opening couple of pages of the book, very first, briefest chapter, just a couple of sentences, concern the subject of loss. And then we move on to the first of many shocks. Here we go.
Okay, and just to begin with, this is stolen as well.
It is?
Yes.
Where is it stolen
from? It's an anecdote that I heard the songwriter Kris Kristofferson say, but he had taken it from, I believe he was a featherweight champion, Willie Pep. There is only one thing I know about life. If you live long enough, you start losing things. Things get stolen from you. First you lose your youth, and then your parents. Then you lose your friends, and finally you end up losing yourself. I was the best drunk driver in the world. I'd been doing it for years. One morning, Sarah came home from work and went back to bed. I tucked her in tight and kissed her forehead and told her not to worry about a thing. I told her to drift off to dreamland and not worry about her night shift, and everything would be better when she woke up. Then I shut the door behind me and snuck down the stairs. I dodged the piles of basement junk and walked to a tiny room where we kept the out-of-tune piano from Sarah's childhood. This is where I kept the big bottle. I took out my empty water bottle from my back pocket, and then I opened up the piano top. The wood creaked eek and popped open like a monster's mouth. "I'm worried about you," Sarah told me a few weeks before. I thought about that now as I reached inside the open upright piano and pulled out the bottle. The piano keys tickled out a tune as I twisted off the bottle top and held the empty water bottle up to it and filled the water bottle full. I listened to its love song. I screwed both lids back on tight, and then I put the big bottle back and shut the piano top shut. It was time for my favorite part. It was time to drive. I drove down the street and through red lights and stop signs shouting stop. I zipped alongside cars at 70 miles an hour and thought, we're all just a few feet from one another. We're all just a few feet from finding out the physics of death. Sometimes I said this stuff out loud, and sometimes I didn't. I slipped onto the interstate and watched the white lines pass and remembered my friend who used to laugh like a maniac when I got in the car and shouted, I'm the best drunk driver in the world, and then hit the gas. And you know what? He was right. It was like his reflexes were improved or something, or it was like he wasn't all tense and nervous and could drive like he wasn't driving. I asked him once what his secret was to never getting pulled over, and he told me to be invisible. I whispered this wisdom now. Be invisible, Scott. Be invisible. I drank from the water bottle full of gin, and I chased it with water from another water bottle, and then I did it again. I reached down into the glove box and pulled out the mouthwash. I popped the top and giggled once and gargled it down. Then I drove towards the blue sky and the purple mountain majesty and spit the mouthwash back into the mouthwash bottle. I listened to the radio and I looked for a CD and I felt what I never felt. I felt calm and I felt glowing and I felt invisible. And so I drove up the interstate hill, invisible. Then I heard Iris talking. Oh, no, I said. I'd forgotten about the kids. I looked into the back seat, and there was my son Sam, and there was my daughter Iris sitting in the back seat. I was always doing stupid stuff like bringing the kids along and forgetting about this, or doing other stuff like putting the kids in the car, not even knowing I was putting the kids in the car. I shouted now, you guys all right back there? You all just sit back and enjoy the drive. Maybe we'll go over to Grandma and Grandpa's. You want to go to Grandma and Grandpa's? They did. I threw my arm in the air and shouted, let's go to Grandma's.
Scott McConaghan, the opening sections from the Sarah book. Well, do you see what I mean about administering shocks? I mean, turning around and finding those kids in the car, and the calm in which it's recited that I often did things like this, and the reader is getting more and more tense as the narrator is getting more and more drunk and calm and glowing, and this is the relationship between the reader and the writer during most of this book until the misery sets in. Mm-hmm. And then the writer is protecting himself a lot of the time from misery by joking, mm-hmm. by living, he thinks, with a woman who knows how to laugh at his jokes. But she does it first. She's a nurse, and she's used to seeing people in pathetic and humbled circumstances. But then she realizes that the man she's married really is a huge, a big, an enormous problem. Mm-hmm. And she needs it to stop, and he has no control over it. But what enters the book is the control he has as a writer.
Yeah, control is something that, something you said earlier. I've tried to make these books that I've written, these kind of big books of emotions and life and feelings, as really sort of subjective, sort of, you know, explosion of emotion. In terms of the book, I found it fascinating in that our first-person narrator, typically with books like these, I'm even thinking Philip Roth's, you know, My Life as a Man, or for me as a reader, there's something about those types of books that feel as if the finger is pointing at someone else, rather than with the best of Roth, which he does plenty, of course, pointing back at the narrator, pointing back at that first-person voice. And so that first chapter, after this little almost thesis statement of the book about losing things, which is contradicted by someone who is not just submissively losing things, but who is simply throwing them away. I liked the tension of that. I liked the tension of showing the worst part of our first-person narrator before the discovery of course, this primary character of Sarah in the book.
And the thing that the book does manage to do is to convince me, the reader, that you love Sarah.
Yeah.
And that Sarah is lovable. And that although by now, at midpoint in the book, you're living in a car in the Walmart parking lot, the narrator's name's Scott, so I think it's okay for me to assume this is the Scott of the book.
Yeah, sure.
Facing me,
yeah.
Who lived in the Walmart parking lot. And this is a book about losing Sarah, mm-hmm. and putting her in a book. And the book can only be written in the basement after this marriage to Sarah has ended. By the end of the book, both Sarah and Scott have remarried. Yes?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So you said in a note to me that the book is full of sorrow and pain and laughter and blood, and it certainly is. Is it the book that you think of as being most of your own, as being most successfully filled with these qualities?
Yes, I believe so. It still feels really kind of close to the bone in a strange way and personal. I think I was able to do something in this book that I had at least started to attempt in Crapalachia. I was able to take the books that I love. You know, the character of Sarah, her maiden name in the book is Johnson, right? A book is being written about a Johnson in much of the similar way as one of my favorite books, The Life of Johnson by Boswell. And, of course, this wise person who's dealing, at least on the level of being a nurse, with life and death every day, is having her story written by almost a buffoon, right? Or at least our idea about Boswell, or at least the way that, of course, Boswell was spoken about in the years after that book. I've always been interested in that merging of forms with biography, anecdote, anecdote that is celebrated almost, that you could almost retell the book out loud once you understood the mechanism of the way that the stories take place.
Yes, it's kind of wonderful. They're like off balance.
I was thinking about country music as I was writing it. It's a Tammy Wynette song, right? Mm-hmm. It's a George Jones song.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Scott McConaghan about love and loss and his book, The Sarah Book. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking to Scott McConaghan about his latest book, The Sarah Book, an intimate and exhilarating tale of love, anger, and the ultimate demise of a relationship in contemporary West Virginia. Sarah's real, right? I'm not asking for me, I'm asking for my audience.
Yeah, there is a real Sarah. I think part of the book, too, is about the person who you think someone is a creation that you yourself oftentimes make. The Sarah that's in the book is, yeah, a fictional creation, in some way kind of a composite of a couple of different relationships, like with any fiction. But I would say that the main storyline that runs throughout the book is based in some ways, of course, upon a factual person.
Now, The earlier books are dedicated to a person named Sarah, and the new books are dedicated to a person named Julia. Mm-hmm. And we learn in the last chapter of the Sarah book that Scott has married a person named Julia. I'm not interested in the truth of any of this. I'm interested in the writing qualities that you're talking about. You tell me, for instance, that the chapter in which you write about the birth of your first child, that you learned how to do the details from a book by Mikhail Bulgakov,
yes,
which was The Life of Moliere. You are a teacher, I assume, of composition, of English,
at
a community college. And you know what happens for a writer who reads, and I hope most writers are writers who read, is that you take home with you, the way someone else might go to a grocery store and say, this might be good for dinner. You take home from the shelves of what you read phrases and sentences, and you try them out in chapters of the book. That's what writing is about, or at least writing like this. Mm-hmm. Realism that comes from an experience of loving books and music to express the life around you, yeah?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. There's something within me, and I don't know if it's... I want to be seen as a writer in the same way that someone who writes, you know, a great fiction is seen as a writer. There's something within our kind of literary culture in some ways that, I don't know, kind of scoffs at writing from life, so to speak. But all of the things that I've loved in literature, whether it's, I don't know, you know, Rousseau's Confessions or even, you know, Roman poet Catullus, right? They've they felt incredibly close to the rioter, or at least to our imagination of the events of the rioter.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, I prefer, this is just as confessional as it gets, I prefer reading to life.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that the reading has to be...
I think I do, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think many of us literary types do. Yeah. But that doesn't mean that the story has to be outlandish and improbable.
Yeah.
What it has to be is literary.
Mm-hmm.
And what you've done by filching here and there, plagiarizing, is to make sure that the quality, that the tone of the book is literary.
Mm-hmm.
There are what I'm calling these short, sharp shocks that are surprises, the surprises that words that you don't expect in a sentence provide when you encounter them. Now tell me, is the deep emotional honesty that I find in the Sarah book related to the world of West Virginia and the people there?
It's a question that I think about a lot of times. I've never been able to leave the place when everyone I grew up with is gone, right? Not only have I remained there, but I've also, you know, my wife Julia isn't from there. Like, I've brought people into the place. And yeah, I think there's a definite sort of connection between West Virginia and not only just in terms of subject matter, but it's one of those things I go back and forth. You know, is Faulkner Faulkner if he's not in Oxford, Mississippi? I'm not sure, right?
Let's also say that wherever we're from, we've got to mine what we have.
Yeah.
And that word mine comes in particular to significance in West Virginia.
Yeah.
Crampolachia is hilarious. The Sarah book is heartrending. It's interesting that you've moved in tone from book to book this way, but you're hilarious or heartrending. You're trying to tell the truth,
mm-hmm.
which is something that's very hard to do if you're talking about a truth you know.
Mm-hmm.
If it's a truth you're making up, you can build it block by block any way you want.
Yeah.
But you can tell this marriage is murder to go over and reconstitute, true and falsehood, whatever, I'm not going to ask. But there is a feeling throughout the book of agony.
Yeah, yeah. I guess back to your original question, too, I'm not sure that my West Virginia exists except in my brain. I'm not sure if Faulkner's Mississippi exists or Willa Cather's Nebraska or whatever you want to talk about exists separate and apart from their kind of internal interior makeup. And I guess that's when we get into these, you know, discussions of Appalachian literature or popular books about Appalachia, I've always felt that it's kind of silly, at least from my point of view, to even like critique it, because it's just simply my creation. It's my place, but the place that lives in my brain. Last year, I reread Life on the Mississippi, and I was just thinking, this is so revolutionary, right? The blending together of like, journalism and memoir and history and descriptions of a river that go on page after page after page. There's a freshness in that voice that I've always loved. When I was a boy, one of the first books that I bought with my own money was the portable Mark Twain. And I had these various portables.
They were
and
wonderful.
I've lived with that book. I still have it.
Now tell me, final question. I know that you haven't left home. Can you, do you think, in the course of a book?
Oh, yeah, for sure. That's what I love about reading. The the physics of that, of, I think it's the most, I wouldn't even say erotic sort of experience that you can have, inhabiting, or someone, a writer inhabiting you, and with our great poets even, controlling your breath even. That strange sort of meeting of, and time travel, I think I even talk about it in the Sarah book when I'm reading the children's book at the end, that sense of time travel, that here's this person who is dead and gone, but their energy is alive, and their energy is alive in that work, and I'm feeling that particular energy. Yeah, makes me think of Isaac Dennison, I believe, where she says something about being a mental traveler, right? Where you can go and inhabit all of these other things and all these other places through books.
I've been speaking with Scott McConaghan, author of the Sarah book, published by Tyrant Books, also of Crapalacha, published by $2 Radio, two wonderful books expressive of the life of someone born and married in West Virginia. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Michael.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from the Sarah book at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. Special thanks to Michelle Escobar for production, to Alan Howard, who came in specially today to produce the show. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to my assistant, Sean Sullivan. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I'm a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. And we're just reading this, reading this, reading this, this, reading this, this, this. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me next time on Bookworm, when Dave Eggers and Mokhtar Akhundzhali are my guests.